Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. It's gorgeous outside, if you don't mind 50-mile-an-hour winds. It's really cold, but the sun is shining, and I was out before, and it really, you know, it's not so bad to walk when the wind is so great. It makes you wakes you up. So you're going to wake up even better because you're going to learn all about dream slipping, and the next time you slip into somebody's dream, you might think twice before you do it. So for most people, dreams are a way to escape reality. Yeah, they are, but then they could be scary too. But if you're Cat McCormick, they're a way to get closer to the truth. Now, wouldn't that be cool if you could slip into somebody's dreams and you're a police officer and actually solve the crime? After graduating college with a degree in criminal justice, but in a little way of real-life experience, she moves into the Midwest to Seattle to apprentice with her granny Grace. That is so cool. Who shares the ability. Granny uses dream slipping as a private investigator, and she plans to follow in her footsteps. And I'm not telling you any more because the author is here, Lisa Brunette, and she's going to tell you about Cat in the Flock. And if you know the character's name is Cat, you'll figure out what that means. Good morning. How you doing?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Now, when you created this novel, why dream slipping? And how would you define it for our listeners? And they're out there, I can tell you now.
Well, I've always been really fascinated with dreams. It's funny, my mom has this picture of me having fallen asleep on the couch reading a book, and the book is facing out, and the cover of it says, Sleep and Dreams, and there's a sort of psychedelic photo on the cover. And that's pretty emblematic of my interests when I was younger. And I've always been a very active dreamer. I've had lucid dreams. I even had a spate of PTSD-related dreams myself. So I wanted to write about that because it's such a compelling experience for all of us. We spend half our lives sleeping, and so much happens while we're asleep. I thought it would be really interesting to see what a person could do if they could go one step further and slip into other people's dreams and then use that to solve crime. And what I'm really fascinated by all the complications that involve.
Wow, that is true. So Kat had different relationships with many of the characters in this novel, the first, Granny Grace, and the second, her parents. How are they different?
So Granny Grace is one of these iconoclast, flamboyant characters. She's what everyone wants to be when they grow up, right? She's 77 years old and has had this trailblazing experience in life, always being on the cutting edge and doing things that weren't open to traditional gender roles or breaking traditional gender roles, so to speak. And she is held up by Kat as this great example of how to embrace your dream slipping gift and use it in a very practical way, which Kat comes from a very conservative Catholic upbringing in the Midwest. Her mother, Granny Grace's daughter, is very different. She does not have the dream slipping gift and so has been without that kind of designation as an outsider in her life. And so her life has been much more a craving for conformity. And so Kat is there sort of as the balance between those two extremes, both politically and then personally with the dream slipping gift, which Kat's own mother doesn't even fully believe exists or won't fully acknowledge that it's a real thing. And then there's the father character is sort of this charming outsider. He loves all these women very much and only wishes that they would get along better.
So that's interesting. So when Kat dreams, or somebody has this type of thing, dream when they just slip into somebody's dream, what happens when they wake up?
Well, Kat has sort of this nascent ability that she's trying to get a handle on, especially here in Cat in the Flock, the first book in the series. And so for her, the dream slipping is not very well focused or honed. She doesn't know who she'll pick up at any time. But at this point in her training, she can only pick up dreams that are from someone dreaming in proximity to her. Maybe within 500 feet or so in the same house or nearby. she will slip in and she gets the sensation that this is someone else's dreams. It's very different from her own dreams. She gets this feeling that she's walking around in someone else's consciousness and can even see their body in the dream and get a sense. In fact, Granny Grass trains her, look at your hands. Are those your hands? And if they're not, then she knows she's slipping into someone else's dream. But she'll remember the dream afterward, and they're more powerful than her own dreams because they're just so startling in their information, and they're usually about something that's highly dramatic. She rarely slips into mundane dreams. Even when she's dream slipping inadvertently with her parents, the dreams that they have give her great insight into who they are, and they're things that they would never tell her in real life. So they're very memorable in that way. Later on in the cases, though, Granny Grace will tell her to get into the habit of immediately writing the dreams down, which is true for everyone. We tend to forget our dreams right away upon waking because our everyday life interferes with that world. And people who study dreams tell you that that's something you should try to do is immediately upon waking, write them down. If you wake up in the middle of the night from a nightmare and you want to get insight from it, sit down and write out as much of it as you can remember because it starts to fade right away.
Wow, that's amazing. But what happens when it affects her, just what she's doing during the day? Does it come into play? Does it ever affect her? When she remembers so vividly that the dream was like there's something haunting her, would that affect her during the day?
Oh, yes, especially since she's actively trying to use this as a way to solve crime. It gives her an edge in the world of private investigating for sure. Mm-hmm. So when she first comes to Seattle, though, she is, like a lot of recent college grads, unable to find work, and Granny Grace is not doing as well financially as she had let on. So Kat has to take work as a security guard, and she slips into a dream while she's on that site. And it's so upsetting to her that it drives her to essentially break into the half-finished condominium project that she's supposed to be guarding. And she knows that's against the rules, obviously, but she's so compelled that there's someone in there in trouble that it drives her to do that. And in fact, when the novel opens, she's on the plane and she slips into the dreams of a child, and it's a nightmare dream and very upsetting, and it stays with Kat perhaps even more powerfully than if it had been her own nightmare.
Well, we'll get to those questions in a minute because I have that in front of me. But what are the rules that Granny set up for dream slipping? What is she not supposed to do, and what is she allowed to do? Because Kat does what she wants to do.
Yes, you've mentioned there. So Granny Grace has set up some rules, and readers who get to the second book will see that there is some flexibility there when the reason warrants it. But Granny Grace does not believe in using the dreams of someone you're close to in your relationship with them. So she actively dissuades Kat from the two of them slipping into each other's dreams, that's sort of it's a moratorium on people close to you. So when Kat begins to date, Granny Grace would not advise slipping into the dreams of her partner because she has this belief that in that realm of human relationship and people who are close to you, you don't want to intrude, you don't want to use the information in someone's dream against them. And an example of that right away in the beginning of Kat and the Flock is that Kat, of course, does slip into her grandmother's dreams because she hasn't figured out how to not slip into anyone's dreams yet. And she learns about her grandmother's debt, and that pushes her to invade her grandmother's study and take a look at some of her financials. And then she confronts her grandmother. And, of course, her grandmother feels very betrayed by this. This is a violation of her privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And and for Granny Grace, it's a violation of that very important rule that you can't use something you find in someone's dream against them in real life. especially if they're a loved one, someone close to you. Of course, it's perfectly fine to be invading the dreams of suspects and using that information to solve a case. But when it comes to the people you love, especially if they're living with you, then that's the moratorium.
Well, if she uncovers something about someone that's close to her that's in trouble, then she really can't get that mad at her for cheating.
Yeah, exactly. And that's some of what comes into Framed and Burning,
yeah,
which is the second book in the series.
When is that coming out while you're talking about it? Because, of course, I'm going to get it. I'm sure they're going to send it, or you're going to send it. You know, I have to know what happens next. I mean, I don't normally ask people, you know, am I getting it next? Because usually I'll say, why another one? But not this time.
Well, actually, all three books are out, the entire trilogy plus a novella. The box set just published a couple of weeks ago. So on ebook. So the entire Dream Slipper series plus the novella that gives Granny Grace's backstory in the 60s, all of that is out.
They're going to have to print them out for me because I don't read on my computer.
The other two books in the series are also available in paperback. So that would be Framed and Burning. Yeah, it's been a whirlwind 2 years putting out all three books in that time. Framed and Burning came out in the fall of 2015, and then Bound to the Truth in the fall of 2016.
Well, if you decide to do another tour, I'm sure they're going to tell me, you know, that they're there for me to read. Yeah, I'll tell you.
Oh, I appreciate that, Fran. I'll make sure you get a copy.
Oh, definitely, because I have to know what happens next. Now that my I love books like this. I mean, Dream Slipping and Shaped and Telepathic stuff. And I just got, they just sent me Silent Fallen by Patricia Briggs. And she writes about a lot of that kind of stuff also with werewolves. And I'm getting used to reading it.
I'm not familiar with her work, but I'll definitely check that out.
Yeah, they just sent it to me when they realized that I actually know what I'm doing. You know what happens when they don't know you and it's a famous publishing company or a famous author, and I've interviewed her. They said, well, where do you publish your interviews? Oh, probably on my computer, you know, whatever. But Kat learns many things while on the job trying to solve her first case. And like you said before, she had to break into this building, and she finds Sherry and Ruthie, and she finds them, but what happens? What role does the dream slipping, we said dream slipping plays because she could see the little girl in her dream. So when she finally meets them, what does she try to do?
Well, Kat is someone who is hardwired to want to help people. That's why she's driven to apprentice with her grandmother and learn how to use this ability to do good in the world. And she recognizes Ruthie and Sherry from the dream that she had on the plane, because as kismet and fate, Granny Grace would chalk it up to that, they were on the same plane coming from St. Louis. And so Kat knows that when Sherry tells her that she has this story that she's just waiting for her brother and everything's fine, Kat knows that she's lying, and she sees that they're essentially homeless, hiding out in this condominium project that's half finished, and there's tarp and things on the roof, and it's a legacy of the crash. This is taking place when this condominium project basically ran out of funding, or the economy had tanked, so they couldn't finish it, and it was halted. So this woman and this girl are basically in there hiding out, and Kat really wants to get them to a shelter or somewhere else, and the woman balks. But what Kat doesn't know is that her boss at the condominium project actually is hiding them there.
I know, he's hiding them from a person that wasn't supposed to find out that he was there, they were there. And unfortunately, not everything works out, and she sort of created a problem, but eventually, I mean, they might have been found anyway. And how long can you stay like that in a rundown building with nothing? So
right.
No one listens
well,
to Kat
does
who,
notice that
yeah.
they've got some high-end camping
yeah.
equipment, and they're a little better off than, I guess, the average homeless person might be. She sees that their clothes are fairly new, and that the situation just seems kind of fishy to her, and she wonders what they're doing, if they're hiding from someone in particular.
That I would imagine too. After all, if they're so homeless, how would they have anything like that? So,
right.
Who is Lee Stone, and why is he important to Kat, and why are they so often so far apart?
Lee Stone is Kat's childhood sweetheart. Whenever she would come to visit her grandmother in Seattle, and this would be for summers at a time, they had a budding romance. And he's about 3 years older than Kat is, so he's been out in the world a little longer. He's an Army Ranger with all of the danger and excitement that comes along with that role in the world. And there's a real sweetness and a real love between these two, but there's also the complications of their very different lives and how they can end up being together. And so the distance is a way to echo that in a metaphorical sense. It also allows me to take Kat's dream slipping in another direction, and that's that the Kat actually possesses some skills, innate skills with her dream slipping that even her grandmother doesn't always have. So it comes up later in the book that Kat is able to slip into Lee's dreams across thousands of miles. And that's because he is having these PTSD dreams from an experience when he was in battle in Iraq. And the nature of those dreams and the nature of the relationship that he and Kat have, the bond, make it so that his dreams can traverse that immense distance, and Kat wakes up from them. And she finds them very compelling, and the fact that she can slip into his dreams is also exciting and frightening for her, and then there are a lot of possibilities there.
Yeah, there are a lot of possibilities there. Wow. It is interesting. Wouldn't it be nice if we could all log into our spouses or whatever dreams and find out what they're really thinking and know the truth? Except, of course, if they, you know, talk in their sleep, that always helps too, but you never know.
Right.
So who else Fletcher?
Which I've been known to do.
Yeah, you never know, right? Put a little tape recorder there. Who are Fletcher and Bander, and what kind of a job do they offer to Kat?
Fletcher and Bander are they're a couple, two men who live together and are married in Seattle, and they are really, really good friends with Amazing Grace. So when Kat arrives in Seattle and has such a tough time finding a job, they offer her the job at the condominium site. It's their development project. They're a well-to-do couple. One is an architect, and so they have an investment in this condominium. And they know they have a private security firm that handles the security on the site, but they, because it's their project, they can pull strings and say, hey, we've got this person with criminal justice bachelor's degree, and we want her to be on our site. So they actually are the ones who get Kat her first job.
Yeah, but they're not the one, they're not the other person there that's monitoring her. Because, like you said, the security guard is sort of helping these people so that they don't get found out. So in relation to Lee, where do they live? Are they close by?
They are in Seattle proper, and it's nice. I'm glad you picked up on that, Fran. That was one of the I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question before.
See, that's why they gave it to me.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Fletcher and Bander are a nice balance against Lee Stone. So they represent a kind of elite, highly educated, well-to-do Seattle culture. And Lee Stone represents, he's somebody who went into the military as an enlistee. He doesn't have a bachelor's degree, and that's one of the things that he points out as the difference between him and Kat. Yes, she went on to college and he did not. And so he lives in Tacoma, which is 45 minutes to an hour on good traffic, if that ever exists, from Seattle. And he is living in a small sort of bachelor pad overlooking the water in Tacoma. And Tacoma is very working class. It's a lot less expensive than Seattle. His apartment is nice, but it's certainly not the architecturally designed home that Fletcher and Vander lived in. So it's, for me, it's a way to show these two very different experiences of the Puget Sound area and the two types of men it could produce or cultivate, so to speak.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up the fact that they're gay and that they live together. That is great, because a lot of authors don't want to deal with that, and they don't want to deal with that particular issue. Considering I have two cousins that are married that are gay, and they're about to become mothers, seriously. It's great, and everybody in my family wasn't, you know, on board with that, and I personally thought it was really cool, and that's okay.
Yeah, it's life. I mean, I, through the series, I people the world with the same people I know in the real world were inspired by them. I mean, it's not like anyone I know is in the books, but I want my worlds to reflect the reality around me. And that is my reality. And that issue is actually absolutely crucial to the plot of the book. I don't want to plot spoil, but it becomes even more important, even beyond Fletcher and Vander.
That is true, but we're not telling anybody. So, Kat wants to take over her grandmother's business. How would that change the way it was run? And if she decides to take over the business, she's going to take on the case of Ruthie and her mother and the rental car agency. But what happens if she decides to take over and run it her own way? Would that happen?
I don't want to give too much away, but certainly by the end of the third book, we've got Granny Grace handing over the torch, because that's got to happen. I mean, that's what's setting up this first book. That's the whole reason that Kat is there. And you're right, there is a big difference between the way that Kat wants to go about both dream slipping and being a private investigator, and the way that her grandmother has always done it. And through Kat in the Flock especially, her grandmother gets a sense of where those boundaries are, that she's not going to be able to shape Kat into being a mini-me, that Kat's got her own spirituality, her own background, her own politics, her own moral sensibility, and she's younger, too, so some of that is just by virtue of the generation gap, that Kat wants to play a little faster and looser with things, and that she's a diamond in the rough, very unhoned and scattershot in both being a private investigator and being a dream slipper. But eventually, even as she matures and gets a handle on both her gift and her career path, that path is going to look a lot different than her grandmother's. She's not as interested in the new age aspect. She's not as reflective and quiet about it, but she is also has amazing instincts and acts on her instincts in mostly the right ways, although she certainly learns from her mistakes at the outset here.
Well, now we're going to get really interesting, people, because this gets really good. And this is the part where this is what happens when I get a book that is, you know, put together nicely and has large print. It makes it so much easier than the one that I just got that has in font number 2. It makes it really hard to read, and it takes me longer to read something that's 900 pages in one font. So this was like, oh, this is great. I could read this and just sit down and my eyes won't go. So Kat decides to take on the case about Ruthie and her mother, And what happens at the rental car agency? And why does she see a man outside the condo that's watching her? And she very bravely goes to find out, like, who is this? So she decides to go to St. Louis. How come?
Yeah, you know, that is something I had to really think about, whether I wanted to take her back there. But through the process of writing the book, she just had to go back. What happens is she finds someone outside the condo complex, and he has a cover story that he's going golfing, but she doesn't believe it, and she goes and tracks down his name at the rental car agency and discovers that he's actually a personality from the Midwest. He is a very well-known, I guess we used to call them televangelists. He is the head of a fundamentalist Christian church in the Midwest. His name is Jim Plantation. It's the Plantation Church. And his face is on billboards where Cat comes from. This is, would be around the St. Louis area, the Southern Illinois and Missouri Bi-State region. So she recognizes that that is who it is, and that it's possible that Ruth and Sherry are running from him. And she goes back to find out, because they've disappeared by this point. What happens is that Kat tips someone off to the fact that Jim has tracked them down at the condo, and they're basically on the run from him, and Kat wants to find out why. She thinks that he has taken them back with him to St. Louis. So in Kat's mind, the only course here is to follow that trail back to St. Louis, because she sees Sherry and Ruthie in the condominium. They won't leave no matter what she says. And then she sees Jim Plantation outside stalking them. She doesn't know who he is until she goes to the rental car agency. And while she's there, they disappear. At that point, then she finds out it's Jim Plantation, but everyone is gone now. And she thinks that it's her fault. She thinks that she could have saved them from him and didn't. She perceives this as your typical domestic violence situation where the woman and the child has run away and the man has tracked them down. And so she feels an enormous sense of responsibility and guilt and weight about that, and really wants to save them. And she and Granny Grace agrees that the only way is to go back and go undercover in this church and see what's going on.
And that is not, she was very good at it at first. She was really good at it at first. So who is Anita Briggs, and what happens when she and Kat, well, she works at the Plantation Church, but for some reason Anita doesn't exactly blend with her at all. She sort of like tolerates her at times.
Yeah, they have an interesting relationship. At first, Kat is able to convince Anita that she's this wayward youth who's lost and searching for her God. And I think the reason that Kat succeeds at that, and I'm glad that you brought that up, is that Kat herself is very religious and is searching. Mm-hmm. She's always heard the voice of God in her own head. She grew up Catholic. She went to a Catholic university. And she draws on what she knows about that world of people who are very religious, and what she knows about what fundamentalists might want to hear from you. She's also had some acting classes, and so she's able to convince Anita. But through the course of staying there, Anita, who's very perceptive herself, begins to understand, realize that there's another reason that Kat's there and that she's been duped. So Anita has some guilt, too, and a reason to be suspicious of a foreigner in her flock. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, we've got Mercy, and contrast to Joe, her father. And Joe's a great character, but why is he so different from Kat and Mercy? Because you like him, and Mercy, I don't know.
Yeah, Mercy's a little bit harder to deal with for Kat and probably for the reader. Well, I think, you know, Joe, he's a guy. He's outside this tension between the three generations of women. And he doesn't have a dream slipping gift. Unlike Mercy, he acknowledges that it's there. But like a lot of people would, I think, in the face of something like that, he's he's a little uncomfortable with it too. And for him, it's very Midwestern and practical. He just doesn't want Kat to rely on that. He wants her to have real world skills. He's glad that she went to school to learn and get a criminal justice degree. And he encourages her to not rely just on the dreaming. And he's so playful, and I think a lot of relationships have that yin and yang balance, and that's probably what he and Mercy are all about. I mean, it's a little bit opposites attract. He's very lighthearted and jokey, and he diffuses the tension out of most situations, and he very, very much loves all three of these women, so... It's just, he's just a fun character. He has less skin in the game, though, since he doesn't have a dream slipping gift and he's not part of the family line. So he can be a bit distant and even aloof about it at times. And yeah, he's a lot of fun to write. He's the father you want.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'd like to be part of that family to be able to do it. So if they want to adopt me anytime. I would love to be able to do that, yeah, because there are a lot of people in this world who I would like to know what they're really thinking, because I'm very perceptive, as most people know, and I can pretty much tell what you're thinking, but if I could validate it, it would be so much better, seriously.
I know, right? I think, you know, as a writer, that's partly why I created this family. It's your dream family, literally.
Yeah. So before I forget, because I don't want to forget, I have it in front of me. Next Tuesday, special time, Alan Jacobson, 1 p.m., Darkness of Evil, the Karen Vale mystery. Oh, it's really good. And on the next day, and I usually don't do back-to-back shows, but I got roped into this one, but it's okay. Force 10, Double the Penny, Mark Schaff. If you want to really get scared, his books are fantastic. And then I am totally honored on the 14th, New York Times author Terry Chames, The Unsettling of Sam Craddock, the very first book in the series. She went back to write his story and how he became the chief of police. And it's really good. On the 16th, the author of Stolen, the 21st, Anthony France, The Outsider. Oh, my God, is that book great. And we were just talking about gay writers. On the 23rd, Tim Patton, who is one of my favorite roller derby stars ever, that played for the San Francisco Bay Area Bombers, who I actually must have seen at some time when I went to roller derby, wrote My Kill Play, and it's a true story of courage and fortitude because he's got AIDS. And this is a story about what happens when it hits the roller derby and how it affected him and the man that he cared about that lived with him for all those years, David. So I'm going to probably dedicate the show to David that day. And the last one of the month is A Toll in the Ivory Cloud, and that is on the 30th. And that's just some of what I'm up to within the next couple of weeks. And you never know what else I'm going to be doing. So we've got a character that bonds with Kat that's in the this church, and that's Wendy. Why do they seem to be, guide their relationship, and what drives them apart later on?
I love Wendy. She's one of my favorite characters. I hope to bring her back if I get back into the Dream Slipper series here with books 4, 5, and 6.
Oh, nice.
And I haven't brought her back yet, but she is. So Wendy had a very different experience growing up than Kat did. Wendy was a foster child and had a very challenging mother who's still alive and still lives in the area and works at a strip club, actually. So she was taken away from her family and put into foster care. And she's genuinely religious. Her foster parents were very religious. But she just has not had that close family relationship that Kat has. So she's a bit of a counterpoint to Kat in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they bond because I think they share a sense of sarcasm, a
mm-hmm.
sense of, like, telling it like it is. And they love each other's humor and straight talk. And so they're drawn together. But what happens is that the Kat's undercover. So if nothing that she does can be fully true because she's on a mission, she's undercover, she's lying. Everything she's doing there undercover is a lie. And so what that does when Wendy finds out is it breaks the authenticity of their bond. And that's very painful for someone, especially who's grown up in that foster care situation or been betrayed by their own parents. And so it becomes very painful for Wendy. And she reacts by cutting Kat out of her life. And it's a source of great pain for Kat because she really doesn't want her dream slipping ability or her work as a private investigator to end up hurting people. She's driven so strongly by the need to help others and to be sensitive that having something like that happen is very, very hard for Kat. And it shapes her. It shapes her as a person and gives her that bittersweet sense of regret about her chosen path in life and will always be something that she struggles with.
Before I forget to ask this, I'm just adding this question. I'm going through the book and I realize that all the dream scenes are in italics, and they're different people that you included in each of the dream scenes, and they each one affect Kat differently. She sees something different. How did you decide which characters she was going to slip into and what you were going to do, you know, the particular scene that she was going to see?
That's an interesting question. Well, first of all, I'll say that the italics were suggested to me by one of my editors. I put every book through two editors at least, as well as several rounds of beta readers. And I originally didn't have them italicized, but Jim Thompson is my editor. He suggested it, and I thought it was a good idea just to set them off. Yeah. So to slip into various people, you know, it's a really organic part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
People always ask me whether I'm a plotter or a pantser, which are the two designations they use on NaNoWriMo. And I've never felt like I was one or the other. I feel like I'm a hybrid because I'll jot this whole plan out on, I have a wall in my office painted with whiteboard paint. So I just write directly on the wall and it gets very messy and it's more of a mind map. It's not that organized. And I just put everything up. No holds barred. Everything goes up. And so in that original process, I think I had an idea that I wanted her to slip into her grandmother's dreams because that's so uncomfortable, that violation of privacy and that vulnerability of someone can find out your deepest, darkest secrets. And I knew she would be slipping into Lee Stone's dreams because of for somewhat the same reason, but there's also that incredible sexual bond, that passionate bond that comes from a lover. And then I knew that she would be slipping into a dream very early on, even before she got to St. Louis on that plane. And that seemed really important to me, even though there were some risks with getting that way. I really wanted that sense that there's a fate, a spirituality, a coincidence aspect to all of this. Those are the things that we have happen in our real lives. Like, does it seem like the hand of God in there in very subtle ways? So that fueled that. And then beyond those three basic things that I knew I wanted to do, a lot of times I'll just be writing and the dream just occurs organically while I'm writing. And this happens, too, with things that characters say. People will be happy to know that Greg Swenson, who is in Cat in the Flock here as Cat's boss, comes up again in the series. I won't say where. And I knew I wanted him to, just like I know I would love Wendy to come back. But in Greg's case, he just walked into a scene while I was writing. And I'm like, oh, I guess this is where Greg will be. And he just announced himself and started talking. And as a writer, that doesn't happen nearly enough. Most of the time you're struggling. But he just walked in, and I said, okay, Greg, well, cool. I'm glad you're here. Let's see what you're going to do. So that happened with some of the dreams, too. I was writing, and okay, I guess this dream is happening. And I think that happened with the Bollywood dream and the other dream that Kat had, she slipped into a woman's dream who was working on video games. Because I that's what I did, and I still do. I've been in the video game industry as a writer for 10 years. So, and actually, all three of the books in the series have an Easter egg, a reference to video games. So some things are planned, and then some things happen kind of magically and accidentally.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder what would happen if you actually used somebody's real dreams. Ah, we're in business here. The chat room just decided to show up. Yay, finally. I don't know why this happens ever so often where it decides it doesn't like me, but it's back. So those of you that are out there and have a question, you know, feel free to ask. Otherwise, I'll just keep it in mind. I don't care. That's good. So what does Kat think? There's Larry Price, and he's the assistant to Jim Plantation, who runs the cult. And then, of course, this wouldn't be a mystery thriller if there wasn't somebody that was dead. And why do they think that he committed suicide? And I'm not sure that he was one of my favorite characters, but, you know, you had to add a little spice to this. If there was no murder, what's the point? So how come you picked him?
Well, yeah, so Larry Price is dead. So as a character, he only comes through in what other people remember or say about him or things that he's left in terms of maybe the sculpture that he leaves an inscription inside. So they think it's a suicide because it's an apparent suicide, and it's ruled a suicide by the local police department. And the congregation accepts that, even though it's very hard from a Christian standpoint to accept that a leader in your flock decided to do that, which in Christianity there's a huge injunction against suicide. And so that part is, it really rocks the church to its foundation, both that they lose him because he was Jim Plantation's right-hand man, and that they lost him to suicide. But as it turns out, that's far more palatable than the truth, which gets buried.
Well, you can't tell the truth about anything because that wouldn't be good. So Larry Price creates what he calls the scripture. And how does that work with him and Jim Plantation? The times I wondered who was really running the organization, the cult, you might say, Jim or Larry. He became so powerful.
Well, because they had, I don't want to give too much away,
no.
But because they had such a strong relationship, there, I think, was probably some blurring. And then you have other players in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
There's a man named Reynolds Chambers who really comes to the fore when the two leaders are kind of knocked out in one fell swoop, because Jim Plantation goes missing when he goes after Sherry and Ruthie. And Reynolds Chambers has to step in, and he's this quintessential patriarch who brings everything back together in the end. And then there's Anita Briggs, who has an enormous amount of power for a woman in a fairly sexist church, which is kind of an interesting antagonism. I love to play with that. I know a lot about the world because my own family and my previous marriage both had fundamentalists throughout. So I know something about that world. And then my husband now had spent some time in the Jim Taggart Church. So I interviewed him at length over all the the time we've been together, and he's told me some really interesting things about that experience that have to do with the role of women. And so mm-hmm. I was really captivated by the idea that Anita Briggs could be this power center in the church, even though she's a woman and she's never going to be named the head of the church. But what can she do within these roles? And you get a sense of that when Kat breaks into Larry Price's office so that she can snoop around, and Reynolds' chambers catches her. And one of the scenes that I found oddly the most disturbing to write because of the mm-hmm. way that Chambers reacts to Kat in that situation.
Well, he does, and he's another one of those characters. Be interesting to bring that one back, too. Kat finds herself very drawn to Lee more and more, but why does Craig fire her, but later comes back into play because of Ruth and Sherry? So he fires her because he doesn't like the fact that she's investigating and trying to find Ruth and Sherry. So how come he fires her from the security job? I thought he couldn't because the other two owned it, but he does.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. For Greg, it's a highly emotional situation.
Yeah.
He's in over his head. He's mm-hmm. out of his depth on this one. And he's got some connections, but he's having trouble. He's trying to get Ruthie and Sherry moved to Canada. And he's got them in this condo site because he knows that Jim will track them down to his own home. So he's trying to keep them in hiding, which is an aspect of women who are fleeing their husbands in domestic violence situations have that same issue of trying to hide and take on anonymity so that the man can't track them down. And especially in this case, Jim Plantation is a very powerful man, and he has a lot of resources that Greg, as a security guard, middle manager, does not have. So when Kat threatens that, when she essentially blows that open and he realizes that Jim Plantation has tracked down his sister and her daughter despite all of his efforts, he just sort of flips out and he's trying to damage control. So he fires Kat because he's got cause since she broke into the condominium. That's mm-hmm. an easy one for him. That's a firing offense. Obviously, he could even press charges against her, probably, but he's going to let that go. And what he does is he tries to move Sherry and Ruthie to another location. Of course, Kat thinks that she's lost them at that point.
Well, I just got an email. Cheryl's listening. Hi, Cheryl. And she asked me how the interview was going, and I said, it's fantastic. I told you, they listen to everything I do. And the people at Partners in Crime really know how to do a book tour. So if you want to talk to Cheryl, Gina, or Wendy, you would definitely not make a mistake. And I have to tell everybody, including that they read every book and they review every one of them. And they won't take a book unless it's really 4 or 5 stars either, that I know also. And also with Partners in Crime, you can't post anything negative. So you never have to worry about somebody writing something awful. And they don't put any negatives in their reviews because I know, because they didn't put any of mine either. Which I think was fantastic. So Lee is plagued by his time in Iraq, and Kat slips into his dreams. What does she hope to accomplish by doing that? I've got about 6 more questions. So this is good.
Yeah, that's a great question. She mm-hmm. really is drawn into these dreams at first inadvertently. Mm-hmm. It's almost just so powerful that that dream takes her. So she can't not slip into them, and she, because they're recurring PTSD dreams for Lee, they become these recurring nightmares for Kat to dream slip into. And so she starts to get a sense that he's traumatized, that he's got something he feels terrible about that he needs to let go. So she essentially uses the dream to help him let go of it. And it's almost like being a psychologist dream slipper, being able to go into someone's dream and mm-hmm. in the middle of that trauma start directing him. And it's a very emotional, very powerful thing for her to do. It takes quite a lot.
One of the questions I would ask, because I'm a reading specialist, reading and writing staff development specialist forever, and I tutor
cool.
children that have difficulties in reading. Yeah, I have my degree. I have 4 master's degrees, and 2 of them are in reading and learning disabilities, and I love it. And there are many relationships that change in the story. For example, Kat with her mother and grandmother, Wendy and her mother. I thought that trip to the club was fantastic, her meeting Kat and Wendy taking her there. Well, that scene was great. And Jim and his relationship with both Ruthie and Sherry. So why the focus on family relationships, the church, and we said the religion and of God? That made it, you know, more believable. But when she goes to see her mother, Wendy, that's the start of a new relationship with her, and that's fantastic. So why include basically it's family relationships throughout the story, and saving people from themselves too. So how come you included that?
Well, first let me say knowing your background makes a lot of sense now because these are some of the best questions I've ever had.
Thank you.
So thanks for that. And, that's something that is so important to me. As a writer, I tell people sometimes that what I'm doing is a cozy mashup, because the reason I love cozy mysteries is because of the emphasis on family relationships. Mm. And what I tried to do with the series, my goal was to wed that to the plot-turning suspense thriller aspects that you get from other novels mm-hmm. that don't necessarily have that. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, nobody in Gone Girl is likable. And Julian Flynn will be the first to tell you that.
I gave it 3 stars, sorry. I really did.
Oh, did you? Well, I love Julian Flynn. I love her work, but in my own writing, what I wanted to do was capture mm-hmm. that, the thriller page-turning aspect,
mm-hmm.
and wed them to, I really want to like some of my characters, and I'm so interested in the relationships between people, especially families.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, this is just coming to my head now as we're talking, but I think in Cat in the Flock, Cat goes undercover, and that's a family too. That
uh-huh.
church is functioning as a family, and it's got its own dysfunction, it's got its own secrets and lies, and sussing out the truth by plucking on the strings that pull people to each other is just a really fascinating place to be as a writer. I love that, and I'm so happy that readers are responding to it and picking it up and saying, wow, I love all these characters. And it's just a very rich writing experience for me to think about how a family copes with something like an ability and the ways that would make them estranged from each other, as in the case of Mercy and Grace, mm-hmm. and then pull them to each other, as in the case of this grandmother-granddaughter relationship, which really got me started on the book. That's what I wanted to do, was write about that, because it's not something I see often anywhere in fiction,
well, you did,
whether movies or TV.
Actually, the title, too, if anybody thinks the definition of flock, which is a crowd of a lot of people, or a crowd of birds, or a crowd of animals, whatever, but if you really think about it, there's a whole flock of families in this book, too.
Yeah, you're right.
Cat seems to be part of each one of them. So another question I would have asked one of my reading kids, because you read a lot of stories about different characters, Cat changes as a person from the beginning to the end of the story, and how? Because she's not the same person at the end that she was at the beginning.
Right. She's pretty green at the beginning, recent college grad. Mm. She admits that most of her experience is strictly textbook. She certainly hasn't had to deal with this real-life experience of a woman and girl on the run before. So she's very reactionary, which I think is a hallmark of that age, being 22. And that's okay. I don't judge Kat too harshly, and I hope readers mm-hmm. don't. And she's her own best critic.
mm.
She becomes very upset when she thinks she's lost Ruthie and Sherry. When she thinks that she delivered them into the hands of their stalker, that's
mm.
devastating for her. And so she acts. But by the end, I think she has taken on a lot of her grandmother's sensibilities and skills. She's learned a lot. She's seen what she can see in a dream and how to use that and not use it. And I think especially with the relationships between her and Wendy and her and Lee, she is very, almost maybe overly sensitive to how her ability can both help and hurt people. And the fact that she has hurt some people as well as allowed them to release is something that she's going to try to reconcile, especially in the second novel, Framed and Burning.
I guess she's going to have to learn how to control them too, in a sense, too. Because you're right, because she can hurt them, she could hurt people and help people, and then somebody might not want to be saved, and somebody might want to be saved, because you hear the voices, which is a really great part. You hear the person's voice of who she's slipping into the dream. It's almost as if, because of the italics, which made it easier to understand, that you're right there. You're right there in the dream with her. And then for those of us that read Lucidity last week, lucid dreams, and you wake up and you say, oh my God, I control the situation. So I wonder what happened if she actually could control what happened also. So what important wouldn't that be interesting if at the end she decides what's going to happen by herself? Yeah, okay, I'm slipping into your dream.
Her grandmother does that. Her grandmother teaches her a little bit of that, and then that comes up further in the series. So I'm glad you brought it up.
I'm getting good at this. I have to admit, I'm really good at this because my mother made me read 10 books a week and take notes on them. Seriously.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
She's thinking maybe you were a dream flipper, Fran.
I'm beginning to wonder about that, too. Yeah. Well, you know, I do. Everybody has lucid dreams. And the other night I said to my husband, how did you wind up here when I was over there? And he just looked at me as if I was completely off a wall. I said, I told you where I was going to be, and it took you 20 hours to find me. How could you not find me? And the cab service wouldn't come, and he didn't know where I was. So it's like it was really weird. She learns a whole bunch of life lessons, but I know you're planning a sequel, and we've got about 3 minutes, which is good. Tell us about where we can get the second novel, the first novel, where we can learn about more about you and your writing and your work. And are there any other types of novels that you've written? I'm just going to include that.
Sure. So the entire series, Cat in the Flock, Framed and Burning, and Bound to the Truth, it's the trilogy at this point, is available in paperback. The first two novels are also on audiobook. So, and they're available everywhere. Everywhere that ebooks are sold, everywhere you can get paperbacks, everywhere you can get audiobooks, whether that's iTunes or Audible. So Not Amazon exclusive in this case. I've gone the full route. And working on the audiobook for the third, and then the box set of the entire series plus the novella are available in ebook only right now.
So when you do an audio, there's one person? There's one person that reads all the parts, that reads the whole thing? Or is there somebody that plays Cat?
So I had two different ones, because what happens across the series is that you get a stronger voice for Kat in the first book and then more of Grandmother Grace and her brother Mick, who is a really interesting other character. So he's a male dream flipper, and he's kind of the crux of the second novel. So I have two different voice actors for Cat in the Flock and Framed and Burning. And that was deliberate. So the first one is a little more young, as a younger voice actress who nailed the Cat voice perfectly. And then the second one, I really wanted someone who could do both Mick and Grandmother Grace as well. So, it was a lot of fun. I worked with voice actors when I'm in video games, so I had some experience at it already. And it's always interesting to test different voices and see which one seems to fit the book best.
I wonder what would happen if Kat slipped into a video game and had a dream about one of the characters in there. That might be kind of weird. kind of different. So this is really a good series, and I really need to read the next two books, people, because I have to know what happens next, which would really be great. So those of you that, let's see, what's coming up in 2 weeks, St. Patrick's Day, and I know people like presents. I do, for every holiday. And yeah, that would be really cool. I think that's great. And I
and
have
Kat's
to tell you
Irish.
That. Yeah, seriously, Irish.
She's
and,
McCormick.
Kat and the Fly, yes, exactly. And this book, Cat in the Flock, there's a young guy that works in the bakery. He's in college going for his degree in business, and he asked me if I had anything about supernatural and dream lifting, so he's getting this later.
All right,
and
excellent.
Yeah, I am so touched by the fact that I walk in, they're all college students that work there, and they know I'm a book reviewer and a radio show host, and they say, what do you got for us to read? So one took the new R.L. Stein book that's coming out in April, Give Us a Kill, it's fantastic. And for those of you that don't know what to read, trust me, Cat in the Flock, you want to read it, and you want to also read my kill play, Tim Patton, about what happens when AIDS hits the roller derby. And you want to read The Outsider by Anthony France because, oh, my God, he's fantastic. And you also want to read Lucidity, and you want to read Nightbird by Brian Freeman. And that's just of a couple that I've read recently. I start 10 books at one time, and I read them all at once. It makes it so much easier just to stay alert and awake. And that's what my mother used to make me do, so I'm proud to do it. But I want to thank you so much. This has been great. And when you send me the other two books, we could talk about them again because I think everybody
Excellent.
Wants to know what happens next to Kat. And really, this has been a fun interview. And I want to thank you, everyone. It's beautiful outside. And, yeah, there's still 90-mile-an-hour winds out there, but that's not going to stop Fran from going out. Doesn't stop me at all. The only thing that's going to stop me is if it snows tomorrow. That's no fun. What can I say? So for those of you that are in upper New York, upper Westchester, the sun's shining. It's beautiful. And for those of you that are in snowy, cold weather, if you don't know what to do, pass the time and read a book. And I would start with Cat in the Flock. Lisa, thank you so very much. Cheryl, Wendy, and Gina, thank you again for sending me one of your another 5-star authors. Watch for my review. In about 5 minutes, it's going to be on my site, Just Reviews. Thank you, Lisa. Have a great day, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Fran, for the excellent questions and a wonderful time today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And everybody, bye.
Bye.